Hi and welcome to Better Off Red. This is episode 35 and I'm Pip Adam. In this episode, I got together with Emma Hislop and we had a conversation about Mary Gateskill's novel, The Mayor. Emma is a really talented short fiction writer. You can read her work in Sport 44 and Turbine and Eka 4. I highly recommend you hunt out some of Emma Hislop's work because there's stuff going on there which I think is pretty freaking exciting. So yeah, she's an amazing writer. So the conversation with Emma about Mary Gateskill's novel took place after about a 3 or 4 week period where Emma and I were reading the book almost page for page. I know this because we were talking to each other over Messenger about the book. I love Mary Gateskill's work. I have loved it since about 2007 when I first read Bad Behaviour. I think she's possibly my favourite writer. And I feel like with all her work, I have baggage and I bring that baggage and I always find her work challenging. She seems to want to talk about the things that I want to cover up and I really enjoy that experience. And I think with The Mayor, it was challenging for those reasons. But what I loved about it and what I hope comes across in this conversation is that, you know, The Mayor is an answer for every assertion or certainty that I have about what is good writing, what we should write about, what we shouldn't talk about, what we should keep covered, what we should uncover. And I think that is what I find most invigorating and exciting and agitating about Gateskill's work is that, I live in this world where I create this kind of bubble where I say, this is good writing, this is what we do, this is how we do it. And then I read a book like The Mayor and it completely explodes everything that I believed. And I really love that. And I think this is, this is the other wonderful thing about that book is that as I was reading it, and I hope that shows in the conversation with Emma too, is that there was just this struggle because it's new, because it's different, because it's, challenging me personally, challenging me as a reader, challenging me as a writer. It was a really, I keep thinking of the word invigorating. It was like a cold shower. It was like agitating and worrying and challenging and beautiful and it was incredible. I think the experience that most explains it to me is that I was reading through it, very conscious of reading through it, and then found myself crying. There is something that books can do and to sort of help us in our real life, and I think that this is one of those books. So I hope you enjoy the conversation and thanks heaps for listening. Okay, so here we are. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Pip.
How's it going?
Good, how are you?
Very good. I'm very comfortable in your writing room.
Good. Great. Not a lot of writing taking place at the moment, but here we have it.
Well, it's very comfortable and nice. Now, thank you for getting together with me today. We are talking about The Mayor by Mary Gateskill.
Yeah, indeed.
Dum, dum, dum. I was just looking over, while you and I were reading this, we were in contact over Facebook.
Supporting one another through it.
It did feel like that. It felt like a support group. And I'm just looking back over our conversation and there's a lot of swear words.
Yep.
Mainly from me. Although you threw in a few.
I did. It's true.
But I think it's quite interesting. Like one of the first comments I make is that I hated it to start off with. And there is a lot to not like about this book.
Yeah, I felt that I hated it a lot of the time. I almost stopped reading it at one point. But then I couldn't stop thinking about it when I was doing other things, like hanging the washing on the line and things, and I felt compelled to keep going. So I'm glad I did.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, I put this book off for a long time. Like, I love Mary Gateskill. You love Mary Gateskill, I think. Would it be fair to say that?
Yeah, I'm quite new to Gateskill. I think maybe you introduced me to her, actually. And I loved her collection of short stories, Bad Behaviour. That's all I've read, but I loved them.
Yeah. And I think, the reasons I put this off were twofold, well, for several fold. First of all, it's about a horse, and I don't feel compelled to read about horses.
Right.
Did you did the horse put you off?
I didn't know much about it. I actually read that it was about motherhood initially.
Yeah.
Which intrigued me, having recently become a mother myself.
Yeah.
And wondering how Gate School would tackle that. Yeah, but it is largely about horses, you're right.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that I found really, you know, definitely kind of put me off a little bit is that it's kind of my least favourite narrative style. Like, it's, what would you call it? It's like alternating points of view, isn't it?
Yeah. So really short chapters, sometimes half a page long, and told in the first person through mainly two characters. Was it? And then other characters are introduced later on, other voices, thankfully, I thought.
It's really funny, isn't it? Because that alone, I mean, as part of our conversation when I was looking back over it, I think you write about how, I think we have this short conversation about how possibly this manuscript wouldn't have survived a workshop, you know, because a lot of the things that we maybe conventionally say are good writing, in inverted commas,
yeah,
it breaks, doesn't it?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
It does have that feel about it, like in some ways. Which sounds really arrogant to say because she's such a master at Gate School, but it does feel like an unworkshopped piece of writing in lots of ways, I think. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. There are things like she'll use five sentences in a row beginning with I and things like that, whereas in my MA year, certainly, you know, people would pull you up on that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And after the workshop, you know, you'd take it back and it would be revised. But it didn't bother me in some ways. I admired her for it.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, I feel like a lot of that smoothness wasn't there, which was incredibly refreshing in a way. Like, and I totally agree that, like, often the book had this, I don't know how to put it, but it felt often like it was sort of pushing me further and further out, like it wasn't kind of inviting me in.
Mm.
And part of it was kind of like this sort of, it really felt kind of in your face, like a lot of the narrative styling.
Completely relentless, wasn't it?
It really was.
There was no relief at all, the whole book. I was just like, I kept hoping for some, but there really wasn't.
No, there totally wasn't. Like, I sort of, yeah, I was thinking about it and yeah, I think you're right. Like, the relentlessness, it doesn't relent in content, and it also doesn't relent in style either. Like, and things like, just with that breaking of the rules thing, the thing that I found incredibly ballsy was the point where she brings in, like, we're going sort of one for one, you know, sort of between the young female protagonist and the older female protagonist, and it's sort of like a chapter for her and a chapter for her and a chapter for her and a chapter for her. Mm. And then all of a sudden we get a chapter from Ginger's partner Paul.
Mm.
And it's kind of like, oh, isn't that cheating? You know, like, you know, like, what is this? But it sort of so adds to it, doesn't it?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. And it feels, the style is very raw, isn't it? Which also kind of feels unworkshopped. I think it's almost, yeah. I felt like Paul, her husband, was an interesting device, maybe, do you think? Like, so we could then see Ginger from a distance, like through somebody else's eyes.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Paul, it's really funny because when I was looking through our conversation, we're just like,
I hate Paul.
Fuck Paul. I hate Paul. Fuck him. What's that about? Yeah, I mean, we definitely did not. We were not fans of Paul. But yeah, it is a really interesting thing because, like, maybe, like, what I might be tempted to do is to desperately find a way of saying the things that Paul says from inside the narrative that I'd set up. But it just seems so exciting to sort of get rid of all that kind of sort of crafty cleverness and just say, right, we need someone who can see Ginger
bring
from outside.
On.
Bring him on. Yeah, just bring him on stage and let him talk, you know, which I think is so interesting. Like, and yeah, I think you're right. It just sort of, yeah, like there is something about the you know, like, I wouldn't for a second think that she you know, sort of said, oh, that's good enough or anything like that. Like, it feels worked in a way, but worked in a totally different way to how I would work it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's really weird. Oh, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say it was quite later on in the book too, that Sylvia Vargas, Velma's mother, is introduced. So,
yeah.
And given that she plays such a tank of a character, as they describe her often, you know, it's kind of, it's interesting that it's quite, not late in the book, but certainly partway through, about the same time as Paul is introduced, perhaps, you know.
Yeah, and it's kind of that interesting thing that as soon as Paul's introduced, there's this weird feeling that every time we get a character, I'm wondering if that character is going to get a chance to, you know what I mean? Like, if that character is going to get a chapter, which is kind of quite a strange sort of, what would the word be, kind of disorienting feeling as well, which is quite cool too.
But it's almost like we needed those other characters for a bit of breathing space, I found, between Velvet and Ginger and back and forth. And also there's a lot of travel time in the, from between Brooklyn, where the Vargases live, in upstate New York, isn't it, I think?
I think so, yeah.
Whereas they go back and forth on the train and stuff a lot, so I don't know what that was intended to do. Maybe also breathing time between the kind of...
Yeah, because, I mean, I guess, like, I mean, it would be good to explain a little bit about the plot of the book. I just suddenly realised that might be good. But so what we have is this setup where we have a family from Dominican Republic. I think that Sylvia, who is the mother... arrived, she's the first person from her family to live in America, right? Mm, like, she's sort of came there sort of in her 20s, I think. And she lives with, by herself, she brings up Velvet, who becomes sort of the main protagonist. She's one of the first people we meet. And Velvet's brother, Dante, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Such a great name, Dante. And Dante is such a great character. The brother is such a great character.
Yes.
So they live in Brooklyn, and yeah, I guess you could say quite, yeah, they don't have a lot of money. The mother's working first as a caregiver, and then there is this, like, in the back of the book, Mary Gateskill gives thanks to this organization. So there's an organization where children from, say, underprivileged families in New York are taken upstate to live with families in rural kind of settings.
Yeah.
And this is, Ginger does not have a child. The reason they get involved in this is because she's thinking of having a child with Paul. They decide to try fostering first. And then, so that very early in the book, Ginger meets Velvet. And then, oh boy, it just, yeah, and Ginger lives close to a place where there are horses.
Yeah,
Velvet seems to be a natural on the horses, and yeah, we go from there. So that key relationship seems to be between Ginger and Velvet, eh?
Yeah, yeah. And so they foster her initially for a couple of weeks, don't they?
Yeah.
From the Fresh Air Fund, which is a wonderful
Fresh Air.
Fresh Air Fund. But I actually read recently that Mary Gateskill has fostered children from the Fresh Air Fund in real life.
Wow.
So, because I was a bit like, how does she know all this stuff about, you know, even though it's fiction, I had that kind of battle going on within myself a lot of the time about how would she write such a tricky character as Sylvia Vargas, you know?
Yeah.
Who's an immigrant from the Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
Because
that is one of the things that we talk about a lot in here. You know, maybe because, I don't know, like there's some great stuff in here. We won't publish it because there's also us bashing things. But yeah, there's that really interesting idea that, you know, like Mary Gateskill writes from the point of view of a person who is from the Dominican Republic, who possibly has a slightly different life to her. I don't want to make any claims for what her life was like. But there is that interesting thing that we often, you know, and there's that tricky thing where, you know, the Vargas, there's a lot of violence in the Vargas family. There's, you know, like, whereas the Ginger family is just so, I think at one stage we say in here that, you know, there's violence and abuse happening in both households, but, you know, one is kind of physical, it looks like abuse, it looks like what we would call abuse, but in the other, in Ginger's house, it's just so, man, it's fucked up.
So sterile, isn't it, there? And sort of, they are presented as this sort of clean, I mean, even though Ginger has her issues, she's a recovering addict and things like that, in their relationship certainly isn't perfect. They're still sort of presented as the well-off white sort of couple in the nice house in upstate New York, you know.
Yeah,
it must have been... She traverses all sorts of different characters, doesn't she, in the story?
Completely.
I also read that she found writing the character of Sylvia Vargas incredibly challenging. And initially wasn't sure she could do it justice. And in some ways, I feel like there's more distance with Sylvia maybe than the other characters. Do you? Even though I felt maybe she was a slight caricature in some ways. And also something I noticed is that while the chapters are named like Ginger, Paul, Velvet, she's always Mrs. Vargas.
Yeah.
So it's almost like Gate School couldn't quite get there somehow.
Because I think that, and I mean, this is what I think we constantly applaud, and I think this is the thing when I look back on that conversation that we're constantly talking about is that, you know, and after this book, I went to a book that was very much based in a white family. You know, everyone was white. It was all very white. Someone was having a bit of a problem with their marriage, you know, that kind of thing. And it really, there is something exciting about reading a book that traverses all those characters. And I think that there's sort of an honesty in that portrayal of Mrs. Vargas. It sort of keeps that slight distance in order to sort of say there is a slight distance or something.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like I really like how love is in this book, you know, like especially when it's about mother's love, you know, like love is so complicated in this book.
Yeah. And both those mother type figures, like obviously Sylvia's Velvet's real mother, and then Ginger desperately wants to sort of be a mother figure. And they're so, they're poles apart, you know, and yet obviously both flawed, as we all are as human beings. I feel as a mother, as you say, love is so kind of flawed.
I totally agree. And I was just thinking how, like, there's such weird power play between mothers in this book, eh? Like, because there's also Paul's ex-wife, who is the mother of Paul's child.
Yeah.
And, like, there's some fucking terrifying shit that goes on. I think in here, in this conversation, and I keep writing that I feel like Ginger. You know, like, I just totally related to Ginger and, like, felt like, which I think is what I've always loved about Mary Gateskill's writing, especially in Bad Behaviour, is that it feels like she's writing an experience that I've tried to hide. You know, like, I'm just like, we're all clean and that's kind
solid.
Here.
It's like holding up a mirror, isn't it? I felt the same about Ginger in so many ways.
We both come in on the white pants. Like, Ginger's fashion sense. I just sort of think, oh my God, no, not the white pants. But yeah. And just that... that horrific neediness.
The needing to be adored by your the child, you know, and it just made me cringe a lot too. And she's so desperate to be normal, you know, and the poor woman goes off and does that Christmas play where she's, you get Paul's point of view, don't you, where he sort of sits, says, I married this, you know, this raw alcoholic woman, and underneath she's aunt's Betsy or whoever, you know, because she was playing this terrible part. And
it really is. And I think that goes to what you were saying right at the start. The relentlessness of it is just holy shit. Like, I just keep swearing because that was when we had this conversation, we just kept reverting to that. Like, I was just like,
yeah.
I mean, I was crying by about page 15, you know, like dreadfully sad, but then the discomfort that came after that. And I think we talk about that at one stage as a picture of a cat. We talk about how it's often a book about shame, isn't it? You know, like, I mean, that is so, that's disquieting. That's harder, I think, than writing about cruelty or sadness.
She writes about things that people usually want to cover up, doesn't she? Myself included in that, you know, so, and it's so... there was no hiding from the book. That's what I felt.
I totally agree. Like, I just felt like, I completely agree. Like, it was just, And that's, I mean, and that's sort of what is so interesting when we keep writing to each other in here is like why we're continuing to read.
Yeah.
Like I just...
Well, it was so compelling, wasn't it? You know.
What was compelling about it? Like I, it was kind of, I wanted to know what happened next. That was hugely compelling.
Yeah, and I was hoping for some sort of redemption or some, yeah, and some hope at the end.
Mm, mm.
I was holding on for that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that all stories end like that, and certainly as a writer myself, I don't, you know, I don't often go for that. But I was hoping for that with this book because it had been such a tough read throughout the whole rest of it, you know.
And there are such moments of love and compassion, eh? Like, that's the other thing is, like, it was almost like she paced it for me perfectly where I would get to a point and I'd just think, oh, and there would just be this drop of kindness or this drop of a kind act or this drop of hope and it'd be like, oh, I can read for another 10 pages or something, you know, which I don't think, I can't imagine that a writer sits down and decides to do that, but it just did feel like that.
That's right, you get a little drop of something, yeah. And Velvet's such a, like, fully realised, you know, as a kid, like, I think the book starts when she's 11 and it goes over a period of years that she goes back and forth, doesn't it, between the two houses. But I think that must have been really tricky as well. Like, the two main voices, you've got an adult and you've got a kid. So and Gate School did that so seamlessly. It's almost like Velvet is this psychologically kind of in tune or attuned kid.
Mm.
Like, you know, when you're, I think it's often really hard to write from a kid's point of view as a grown-up.
Mm-hmm. Especially that age as well. Like I was thinking, you know, and I think that is part of, I mean, I can't imagine anyone writing a character like that except Mary Gateskill, just because, you know, like there's no shying away from sexuality. There's no shying away from, you know, like it's not, it could have so easily been a real victim. You know what I mean? Like Velvet could have so easily just been like this poor wide-eyed kind of woman of colour, you know, dredging her way through, you know, but she really has wants and desires and, you know, like, momentum and...
And it's so powerful. Like
she's
probably
real powerful.
I'd say the most powerful character in the book, you know. And when she's on the horses, you know, no one can sort of reach her.
Because that's what I found really interesting as well, is the way the horses, like, they started off being, I don't know, horses from, like, Blue Velvet or, you know, like... horses, you know, but by the end they were these huge scary kind of monsters that we were living with, eh?
Especially
now she starts off being called Fugly Girl but ends up being called Fiery Girl, which is a horse that no one seems to be able to ride except Velvet, who's been abused as, you know, the horse has been abused as well, and like there's something amazing because again, don't talk to animals, you know, don't make animals talk, you know, like don't that would be, you know, if you were making a rule of conventional writing, that would be one of them. But there's something so wonderful about those moments, hey? Like,
Oh my god. And it would be really easy, I think, to get sick of the horses, you know, but I didn't.
Me neither.
You know, like there's a lot of that kind of horse training and all that kind of stuff. Almost horse whispering, really, isn't she? Amazing.
Because you're so right. Like, I mean, that kind of thing doesn't usually hold my attention. You know what I mean? Like, I'm kind of like, oh, yes, interesting information that I don't have. That's interesting. But I found myself, like, Googling bits, you know, that there's a bit where they put a peg on the end of the horse's mouth to get a bridle on it. And, like, I was just like, what does that look like? So I'm like, you know, and I suddenly, it was really... I don't know how she managed to do that. I think it was that very specific kind of language and specific knowledge and so entwined with Velvet and so entwined with the story. Like, you just couldn't... There was no... again, there was no looking away. It wasn't like looking away. Oh, we're done with the horses now.
No, that's right.
You know, relax.
That's right.
You know, like, everything's...
I mean, I had a horse as a kid, so you'd sort of think, oh, well, maybe I'm not that kind of into reading about them. But the way she did it was... Yeah, and all the characters in the stable as well are, you know, the such hard asses, you know? This is so...
In such a woman-centered place. Yeah. You know, like, that was the thing... Like,
Paul was the only guy, wasn't he, apart from the boyfriend?
Yeah, there was Paul, Velvet had a boyfriend that we got to meet. Well, sort of like a boy that we got to meet. Dante was there, but Dante, I don't know, like Dante's so cool.
Yeah, and the golden child.
The golden child. He's just kind of creepy. Yeah. And the way he translates at the end from South Park. Like his mum's speaking in Spanish and he says, oh, what she said was. And yeah, it's just, I really loved Dante. Like I thought he was great. But yeah, I don't, that didn't hit me until a long way through.
A few tenants, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
Who take Velvet's room from time to time, so she sleeps on the sofa.
Oh, the men.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's so true. Like, I think that...
Actually, there are men out in the community, aren't there, when she's walking to visit her boyfriend and stuff like that.
Mm.
There are often men that are sort of depicted as predatory on the bus and on the streets watching her and things.
Yeah, yeah.
But
and that, I think that... It's kind of interesting as well, is that the men are there, but really the roles that they take up are very simplified. Yeah. Like even Paul really only, you know,
two-dimensional.
Yeah,
Paul's
fuck Paul. No, like Paul seems to be there just to be disloyal. You know, like that seems to be Paul's job. Yeah. You know, and even the man that Ginger visits, you know, like. You know, what is he there for except it's kind of that almost turning round of, you know, objectifying women. You know, the men, not that they're not rounded characters, but they are definitely not needed in the stables. They're not needed in the house. You know, they're not needed in places, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
I really love it. I really love it. What else did we have to say? Let me check.
Yeah, I think I'm glad I read it.
Yeah, I think that is the thing, isn't it? Like, I sort of do feel the same way. Like, when I sort of when I got to the end, I was sort of thinking, yeah, I just don't think there was any way I was going to stop because I was so fascinated by it.
Yeah, me too.
Like, I just kept thinking, this shouldn't be working, but it is.
Yeah.
I think that was my primary feeling, was that, you know, like, I was never... And that's what kind of amazes me about it, is that if I take the bits of it and put it together, like if I say it's this kind of narrative, it's got this content, you know, these are the characters, you know, that I would think, oh yeah, nah.
Yeah.
But there's something so wonderful about it that just keeps me reading. It's so wild. It's so wild.
Did you know that Ginger is 47 years old?
No.
10 years younger than Paul, so that's weird, because I didn't imagine them to be that old.
No.
So there's no, well, slim chance she'd have a baby.
No.
Like, weird, eh? Like, they were going to foster a kid.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's right. I think I read that online.
That makes, actually, it does make sense, because he's, see, that completely changes things, doesn't it? Because I don't know if that's because I'm 47, and I thought she was my age, and I think I'm younger.
You're not 47.
Well, 46. But yeah, man,
you look so young. It's because you're
thank
sober.
You. Thank you. That's it. Yeah, they'll do it every time, man. But yeah, because they, I did look at her and think, like in my mind, she was older. But I think that I'm thinking she's younger because I think I'm younger. You know what I mean?
Right. Because my thing was they were going to foster a kid and then try and have a baby, maybe with them. But this,
I totally think that. But
yeah.
Was she? But I guess there's that thing that. The book is over nearly 7 years, isn't
right.
it? So maybe at the start, she's not as old as she is at the end. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like maybe, because that seems like, that
yeah,
seems
that
like
makes
a,
sense.
That seemed like a perfectly picked time to also meet that couple as well, didn't it? You know, like it's sort of probably not going to have a baby naturally.
No.
But you know what I mean? Like it's such an interesting time, that sort of moving over.
Remember how she met Ginger, how she met Velvet.
What, didn't she just come off the bus and there were numbers?
Well, that's
I'm
right.
sure that they just
oh,
had
that's
that.
Right,
and didn't
yeah.
someone want a, wasn't there an awful scene where someone was just saying, don't give me all the dirty ones or something?
That, yeah, there
it was
something.
Just, oh my God.
Terrible, yeah.
Because that's another thing this does so well, is really, it challenged a lot of my privilege, you know what I mean? Like I was sort of reading it and just thinking, oh fuck, I suck. You know what I mean? Like,
so
just this sort of thing where, you know, like, the white people kind of sweep in and help the underprivileged kids.
It
and
was just made you just cringe.
And so much of our society now seems, because of the separation of rich and poor, it seems like there's a lot more of that kind of philanthropic kind of stuff happening. Mm. I don't know. Like, it was really interesting because I was having a discussion. There was an article this week about there are some women in Auckland that don't have access to sanitary products. I hate that word because it makes it sound like we need sanitizing, but they don't have access to tampons and pads and stuff like that. So there are some people that are organizing, you know, fundraisers for all that sort of thing. And it was really interesting because I was talking to a friend about it and we're just saying how this is the world we live in now, you know, like that some people don't have something and depend completely on richer people to give it to them. And for something kind of so personal and private as that, and that's what I think this book did really well, is that it's kind of like, if you are a privileged person and you get to give, you get to feel fucking great about yourself as well, you know? Like, it was just, and there's all that talk about how Velvet's Ginger's project and stuff like that.
Yeah, which, there is.
Like, you know, I don't think Ginger gets very angry when people say that, but there is, I don't know, like, it feels very much sort of a book of the sort of 1%, you know, like this new kind of economy that's sort of building up, you know, where, and you know, like when I look at America, I often think of that philanthropic, you know, like children are at university because rich people have paid for them to go to university. And there's something, it really seems to look that in the eye as well. Eh?
Yeah, totally. Are you recording this?
Yeah.
Good. That's what it is. It's just like, that's why I felt so uncomfortable reading it probably, you know?
Yeah, me too. Like, you know, like I've really got to check myself when I, you know, like when I go out to teach at the prisons or something like that, often I've got to really check myself that I'm not fucking feeling great about, you know, like often, you know, like it can be a bit of an ego boost and I can sort of think, look at me helping people out. And it's kind of like, you know, like I don't like that part of me at all. Like, I mean, so, you know, I'm really grateful because I teach with William, who you know as well, you know, him and I have really tried to build this ethos of sort of decentering ourselves so that we're writing with people, we're not teaching people, you know. And I think that even that, you know, now I sort of can hear it in my voice and I'm congratulating myself about that. But I think that that's what's really nice about this book, is that it sort of problematizes, or it makes difficult that kind of philanthropic kind of like, let us help you kind of stuff, which I think is really good. And that idea that, you know, like that thing of how much we can understand someone else's experience, which I think is really interesting too in there.
Yeah, yeah. Which is why I felt uncomfortable about Gate School writing it initially, I think. Because I was just like, oh, I don't know, you know. But then that opened up a whole lot of stuff about the stories we can tell, you know. And actually, if you start putting rules around fiction and the stories people tell, then you run into all sorts of crap, I think, and problems, and, you know, isn't that what fiction's about? Trying to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and write the story?
I totally agree. Like, I think, I mean, that's the thing. Like I say, like, going from this to that other book that I read that is just all, you know, obviously someone writing what they know and sort of saying, oh, yes, I understand this world, you know, and I think what I really admire is that I think that the book does get it wrong sometimes, and I think, you know, like there will be criticism, but until someone writes this, there's nothing to criticize, you know what I mean? Like,
that's right,
you know, we can't say, you know, like what this brought up for me is, oh, why, you know, like I could only think of one Dominican writer, which is dreadful, but I think, you know, and I just thought, oh, I want to read more Dominican writers, you know, and I guess that that's the argument, you know, in my sort of antagonism towards her, you know, writing this, you know, it made me think, actually, what we really need is more room, you know, we need more voices, we need more varied voices, because, you know, like, this person's having to write this story.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know, like, and
it's not non-fiction anyway, it's fiction, you know.
Yeah.
If we only write what we know, you know, like I just remember my MA year, obviously some of my work, even though it's fiction, was based largely on real life experiences. But Emily would always say that where the good writing really started to happen was, in her opinion, when you started to get some air between that and the fiction, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think totally that's right. Because otherwise, if it's too close to your personal experience, it feels just that.
Yeah, yeah.
To me, anyway.
And that's what we, one of the things that I found really interesting when in my MA year was often people would say, someone would say, I don't buy that that character would do that.
Yeah.
And someone would say, it really happens. And that seemed to be, like, Damien often talked to us about how that was kind of the weakest defense, you know, like that it really happened that way.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes when we're writing so close to the truth, it's fully imagined in our heads.
Mm.
So all that imaginative energy is happening in our heads, so we don't bother on the page, you know yeah. what I mean? Like, we're kind of like, oh, yeah, you know what that house looks like, because yeah. I know what that house looks like.
Yeah.
Whereas I think you're right, I think that where rubber really hits road is when we are, yeah, when we're trying to put some, so, yeah, that happened, but what would have happened if this happened,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what's really interesting.
That's a great description if you're focusing too much on, because you knew it, you know how it happened, so...
Yeah.
It's hard to put it all down.
And I think, like, in this book, like, just thinking about biography and the fiction, I mean, you know, there is that wonderful thing of, yeah, like, I mean, there's a totally different book to be written, which is of a woman who fostered children and kind of writes, say, something like an Elizabeth Gilbert, Eat, Love, Pray, yeah. you know what I mean? Like, yeah. sort of saying, oh, yes, fostering children was amazing, and, yeah, these are some of the experiences, and here's some of the stories of the woman that did it.
Mm.
Whereas this, you're right, like, I mean, fiction allows us to sort of be in Velvet's head, and, again, I think you wrote it in a conversation we had, you know, like, we're not allowed to simplify that any, you know, like, when we see someone whose experience might be similar, you know, Velvet is going to be in our head,
mm.
and it's not easy to just go, they should just
yeah.
blah, blah, you mm. know, because it's kind of happening in the book.
Mm.
It's quite wild, eh?
So much happening in the book.
So much all happening the time. In the book.
Just all like the time. Bits and starts. Just...
that's so true. And yeah. I think that's part of the assault as well, isn't it? Yeah. You know, like, we don't, no one sort of goes for a walk or, you know, well, they do. But there's always something charged happening in that moment. Mm. Like those drives that happen, you know, where Ginger takes Velvet for drives, like, they could be moments of respite, but they're not really because, you know, there's that...
Oh, it's exhausting.
Oh, I just thought, oh, yeah, it's so exhausting. My God. I was just thinking about how that relationship... It's that weird thing that when... I was just thinking about the arc of the book and those drives in particular and how... Ginger's focus just turns further and further away from Velvet and further towards her own stuff, doesn't it, at the end? Like, you feel like she's really there for Velvet at the start, you know, and there's a little bit of self-interest, but by the end...
And also I remember, too, that her mother and sister have both died recently, recently.
Yeah.
Her sister was mentally unwell, wasn't she?
Yeah, that was... Well... It was really interesting because I thought that was where I first started crying, was just the whole missing of the sister thing and just that dreadful feeling that she could have done more. And it kind of felt like that hideous kind of misdiagnosis that sometimes takes place with addicts, you know, like maybe it was a drug addiction, not a, you know, not mental health, you know, like I'm sure it's all, you know, tied up together, but it was being treated for something different than what it was possibly. And yeah, you're right. Like, I mean, there is... And you see, there again, that's a totally different book, isn't it? Where we get more sympathy for Ginger, you know what I mean? Where we start to see, you know, and that, I think, is what's so great as well, is that while I did not like Paul, and I think some people will read this and think Paul's pretty awesome, but I never hated Ginger, but I just found it so hard to read her, you know, just because... She was doing so much stuff that I related to, especially in motherhood, you know, like, oh my gosh, are we dreadful people?
What was that? Was that desperation to be needed? And
totally for
me. Yeah.
Like, yeah, and just that thing of, you know, that weird line between wanting the best for your kid, but also, you know what I mean? Like wanting, you know, wanting the best for yourself.
For you. I've got down here, there is an unsettling neediness to the urgency of her love and her wish to prove herself adequate at loving. That nailed it for me, I think.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
That is exactly it. You know,
she feels less than, you know, doesn't she? That seems to be one of the biggest issues for Ginger.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. And like there is that weird, and again, you know, like that weird shit that goes on with the other mothers. Like, I really felt that very deeply, you know, that idea. And I see it in my friends, you know, where there are some people who have made the decision not to have children and some people that have made the decision to have children. And it seems that we can't all just hang out. Mm. You know, like, it seems that I'm often hearing people, you know, make judgments about people that haven't had children, and then people that haven't had children making judgments about people that have had children. And, you know, and it just seems so interesting, all that stuff as well. I felt that very acutely as well.
Yeah.
You know, having had children slightly later, you know, and like, you know, that and also only having one, I found that quite, because that's often, you know, especially, you know, family members and stuff have sort of noted that that's perhaps selfish to have one child. And Brent always says that we're just selfish. We're just not selfish enough. You know, we're just not selfish enough.
Oh, I love it.
But you know, I think all that power play.
It's a strange subject in which there's, you know, to be so much judgment about, isn't there?
It's totally weird.
I've certainly found it interesting and frustrating having become a mother 20 months ago or whatever it was. And also later on, like, you know, at age 41 or whatever I was. That around personal choices, you know, and actually whether it's, you know, I don't know, let's just say whether to vaccinate or not vaccinate, or to have one kid or five kids, or, you know, whether to sleep train or not sleep train or whatever, you know. And I find myself doing it as well. Like, I...
Yeah,
you know,
oh, yeah.
I think, oh, that's, you know, that's terribly cruel to do that or whatever. I've never felt it so acutely, perhaps, another... Well, maybe becoming a mother has made me more sensitive. I don't know.
Yeah, because I feel the same way. Like, I don't feel like I'm judged like that in my job.
Mm.
You know, I don't feel like... Maybe... I wondered if it's that whole kind of, this is so dumb because I don't believe in environmental psychology. I mean, in what do you call it? I don't believe in like things that are innately us, but I do wonder if it is around, I think that it's a manufactured thing, but we have this idea that children are the future, you know, and like we'd better bring them up, and it takes a village to raise a child, and right, you know, everybody gets a say, kind of, you know, like there's these precious things, and you know, and it's interesting because, you know, I have friends that sort of a staunch anti-abortionist, and they also find this weird thing of this kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, like deifying of the child, you know, the child, you know, and you know, this innocent child, and it's kind of, I do think that might be part of it. Like, I think that everybody sees it, and you know, this whole idea that it's the most important job, and you know,
oh dear,
I know,
yeah.
And you see, that's what I think is so interesting about this book, is that there's so, I have read so few books about motherhood, you know, like adult women with their mothers. I've read a little bit of that, you know, like those kind of fraught relationships, but there's something so great about this that Ginger kind of hits motherhood at 11 years old, you know. And And then we've got Mrs. Vargas, I call her that as well, but we've got Sylvia as well, who, like, has worked all this time to raise this 11-year-old child, and then there's this weird sort of ownership that Ginger feels over this child now that she really has had very little to do with her upbringing, and there's this kind of weird feeling that maybe Ginger thinks she can correct or, you know, like, cure or, you know, like...
Offer her...
Offer
the child something. Oh, there's a bit in the book where she talks about that, I think, about offering the riding of the horse's experience is something that her mother couldn't offer or something, and why Sylvia should be happy about it rather than angry, you know. But of course, Sylvia's terrified that she's going to fall off the horse, and, you know, as anyone would be. But maybe that's why I was so kind of uncomfortable reading the book, was the reading about the mother, you know, the sort of the mothers. You know, you've got Ginger and you've got Sylvia, both of whom are flawed, you know, in my world view. And Sylvia's incredibly violent and beats her kid up a lot. And Ginger is, you know, I don't know, what is ginger? Just really irritating on so many levels, you know. Maybe I was just judging them as mothers, you know.
Maybe. Because
it's interesting that you don't, you've just, you said before, you, there isn't much, like I haven't read much about mothers either.
No.
And in actual fact, I kind of tend to hide the fact that I'm a mother from, like, well, not hide the fact, but I won't have it on my social media accounts, you know.
Yeah.
As some people have mother as, you know, da-da, yeah. But I feel like if it is known that I'm a mother, it might stand against me in some.
Yeah.
What's that about?
I think, and this is what I was thinking, when you were saying that thing about judging the mothers, I also wonder if it's some, okay, now I'm going to go real deep, but I also wonder if it's some kind of patriarchal kind of thing where it's okay to judge mothers, you know, like that's something we do, you know, and we do it to keep the children safe, you know. And I do wonder if slipping into that judgment is another mirror that sort of came up to me, because I was the same. I was kind of like, don't beat your child, you know. And then I was like, you know, obviously, you know, I'm not condoning child abuse, but I just think that it was interesting putting the abuse, because I think Ginger's incredibly abusive. You know, the weird kind of wanting to cut her off from her own family and the strange ownership shit that goes on, and there's some weird emotional stuff that goes on there.
You're right.
Like, really unhealthy stuff.
But it's so hidden. That's why I think I was struggling to find a word for it. Yeah. It was like, she's irritating. She's not fucking irritating. She's abusive.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's just, it's also hidden. Whereas, at least with Sylvia, it's like out there, and it's, you know.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the interesting things as well, that Gateskill's done by setting those two up sort of in opposition to each other, is that, you know, like, yeah, exactly like you say, like, it's almost like, it's like when I see some, now I'm going to get judgmental, but sometimes I see parent, like when I was reading a lot of parenting books, they were all about withdrawing love and giving love. You know, if a child acts in a certain way that you don't like, you withdraw love. And to me, I just thought that was so fucking abusive. Like, it just seems so manipulative and horrible. Yet, we're okay with that as a society. You know what I mean? Like, we're okay with that's, you know, like, there were several books that Plunkett gave me, you know, Nigel Ladder, all this sort of thing. Must be okay. Whereas if you look at Ginger, she's kind of like a heightened version of this.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I think when we look at her, we're like, she's not really abusive. You know, she's, you know, she's just like this. You know, she's doing her best. That kid needs some boundaries, you know. And I just think that is so...
She is. She rings up and she's, if you haven't done your homework and all this, you can't come up and stay next time. And isn't she? She rings up the school and checks up on her all the time and all sorts of creepy things.
It's so creepy. And it's also like this complete misunderstanding of, like, the life that she's in as well. Like, that's the other thing that I found so interesting. Like, I don't think she goes to the Vegas house, does she?
I
like,
don't think so, she ever does.
So she never goes to the neighborhood. She never goes to the house. She never goes to the school. And what she seems to be doing is trying to turn Velvet into what she thinks Velvet needs to be. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, it's that weird thing where she's like, oh.
Whitewashing, sort of. She does. She goes to the school once, do you remember? And she doesn't recognize Velvet in the classroom. She just doesn't recognize her. Just says it all. You
know? Yeah. And I think, I just think it's that weird thing, isn't it? It's kind of like, I can fix this, you know, like I can, which is kind of, it comes from a beautiful place. Like, it comes from a beautiful place of kind of, and both women seem to come from these amazing places, but it's like, circumstances, life, psychology, past experience, all that stuff. And that's what I so love about Mary Gateskill, is people don't get to escape that. You know what I mean? Like, there just seems to be this real understanding that the world around us affects us, you know, which I think is so fucking great. Oh, it's just so good. Oh, Ginger. Now I want to start on Ginger. Poor Ginger. My God. Poor Ginger.
Poor Ginger in the white trousers.
Oh, the white trousers. Did you have a real clear idea of her fashion sense?
I had a clear idea of her too. Like, her sort of, just her body shape and everything. I don't know. I just saw her as kind of like this petite sort of woman with this bob, or I don't know, something really sort of manicured, you know.
Yeah.
And that house, their house was just so sterile. lots of beige, and I don't know if it
was. Beige. So beige.
Yeah, so beige.
Oh my God.
And they also spend a lot of time doing the dishes.
Yes.
Like, you know.
Yeah, and that was the other thing, is like these really weird Little House on the Prairie kind of moments of, doing the dishes. Yeah. You know, that's what she needs. She needs more.
But that's
doing
even
the dishes.
That's even an opportunity for power play, isn't it? It's like everything is so loaded. It's like, they're often in some kind of conflict while the dishes are being done.
Yeah.
You know.
And then there's a moment, I love the moment where Velvet decides not to do the dishes. There's a great moment where she's like, she refused to do the dishes.
Yeah,
and it's like,
right.
It's your house.
Going for a walk.
Yeah, I love her so much.
Yeah.
I can see Brent and Tallulah.
Oh, cool.
They're here.
Yay.
We did it. Thanks, Heat Sima.